what an economist has said about this, actually, his name is Gal Luft, made a very startling observation. He's a co-director of the Washington-based Institute for the Analysis of Global Security. Also co-wrote a book about de-dollarization. He said the oil market, and by extension the entire global commodities market, is the insurance policy of the status of the dollar reserve as the global currency. He says, however, if that block is taken out of the wall will begin to collapse. So there you have another warning coming through, in this case from this particular economist and author. Now, Saudi Arabia's move targets the heart of the U.S. financial system. This is what we're looking at. This is important, how this move does what it says here. And the U.S. financial system has taken advantage of the dollar's reserve status. How has it done that? It has printed as many dollars as needed to fund government spending. So that is what the dollar has meant for the U.S., and that's how the U.S. has actually taken advantage of it. All right, let's find out what our guest thinks about this. Rejoining us is Abid Qayyum Suleri, the Executive Director at Sustainable Development Policy Institute. All right, welcome back. We're taking a look at this phenomenon, really, of Saudi Arabia switching its dollar-denominated oil sales to the petro yuan. Now, tell us the significance of that and the overall impact that's going to have, not only for Saudi Arabia, but the status of the dollar.
Well, one thing that we need to keep in mind that financial sanctions, they should be used as a deterrent, just like your atomic power. Now, the way Western governments, they are using, and I'm not debating rightly or wrongly, but the way these economic sanctions are being used against, those were used against Iraq, those were used against Libya, against Iran, against Afghanistan, of course, North Korea, and now Russia. So countries, they are automatically trying to somehow lessen their dependency on trade in U.S. dollars. They are also trying to lessen their dependencies on placing their reserves in U.S. dollars. And I'm not surprised if China and Russia, China and Saudi Arabia, they would try doing the major part of their trade, energy trade in Chinese yuan.
All right, let's bring in Dr. Timothy Kurzweil, Research Fellow at the Advanced Institute of Global and Contemporary China Studies at Chinese University of Hong Kong. Welcome back. You know, when we take a look at some of the countries that may and have actually enacted this move away from the dollar, we can talk about the Eurasian Economic Union or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Again, some of the countries have moved to de-dollarize, and also ASEAN countries. This ripple effect that the Saudi Arabia switch to the yuan will have, do you think that this is a trend that's continuing, and how far will it accelerate?
There's a lot of nations in Asia that would be really interested in a system like this. We've seen that despite the Western sanctions, most of the countries in Asia and in the developing world more generally are really uninterested in carrying out the sanctions regime of the United States and its allies against Russia. So Pakistan, for example, signed a major trade deal for wheat and natural gas just days after the Russian special operation began. I think the Indian case study really shows the necessity of this system. So India expressed its sovereignty by refusing to vote against Russia in the UN Security Council and then decided to buy Russian oil despite sanction threats from the United States. But one of the difficulties that India faced was finding a payment mechanism for its trade with Russia that doesn't make them subject to these United States sanctions. And they've previously been relying on a dollar-based payment system. So the country is now scrambling to develop a ruble-to-rupee payment mechanism and continue trading to Russia, which is one of its important partners. And what this really shows is the importance of strategic foresight and countries working together to protect their sovereignty and resist the hegemony of the United States system.
The global crisis in Ukraine has pushed Russia and China closer together. The two global powers already had close ties with each other. The Russian-led Eurasian Economic Union and China agreed to design the mechanism for an independent international monetary and financial system. The EAEU consists of Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Belarus, and Armenia, and is establishing free trade deals with other Eurasian nations, progressively interconnecting with the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. Analysts believe China and Russia need to coordinate their strategies to bypass the U.S. unipolar system. The Eurasian system is bound to become a serious alternative to the U.S. dollar. The EAEU may attract not only nations that have joined Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, but also the leading players in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as well as ASEAN. West Asian actors, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, will be inevitably interested. All these factors can contribute to the spread of the new system that will eventually help decrease the influence of the Bretton Woods system. It is now widely believed that the U.S. dollar and imperial hegemony are facing serious challenges.
Let's get real and ask a fundamental question here. Is it really possible to end the dollar dominance? This needs to be looked at through the lens of sanctions, significant ones, against countries like Cuba, Libya, Iraq, North Korea, Iran, Russia, China, and Venezuela, to name a few. The impact of sanctions is major. It has caused the ruble and stock markets to crash. However, Putin has many friends and a number of clients for its oil and gas. Some of them produce a large section of the world's oil, namely Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Iran, each of whom would welcome a stronger and more profitable organization of the petroleum exporting countries. The Russian president will be counting on its friend China to see how it can assist him in the time of this transition. Their border disputes have been resolved, and both have one common enemy, the US. This can only mean closer cooperation on trade, investments, and currency in particular, eliminating the dollar, or what's called de-dollarization. On that note, China will continue to draw down its U.S. dollar-denominated foreign exchange reserves of about $1 trillion in its war chest of $3.4 trillion. Since 2005, China's share of dollar securities has fallen from 80% to just 30%. Some have said the dollar has committed suicide regarding its image as a safe haven. For this to happen, we need to look at the Federal Reserve. For many decades, the U.S. Federal Reserve prided itself in its position that every single dollar printed is backed by the government and will be honored. Yet, certain U.S. moves have killed that claim. Freezing half of Afghanistan's $7 billion foreign exchange reserves and all of Russia's foreign exchange dollars are a couple of examples. Any central bank will now think twice before buying U.S. treasuries and will always look for alternative safe assets, even if they may be less safe. And finally, Asian and African central banks will be reassessing their reliance on the U.S. dollar and trade dependencies on the U.S., and even their trust in the U.S. as a whole. India's sustained abstentions on anti-Russian resolutions are very strong statements of support. That too, despite sustained pressure from the EU and the U.S. That does it for this section.
The world is going through a tectonic shift when it comes to the energy market. The U.S. move to cut Russian oil off the market has not gone as planned for the United States. I mean, Europe has said it will not cut off Russian oil and gas purchases. It's going to try to do so before the year 2030. That's, well, 9 years from now. With the U.S. sanctions on anyone buying Russian energy, that, in a sense, is only going to backfire and work against the U.S. since countries will look at alternative ways to buy the oil. Saudi Arabia's move is one example of a producer switching to the yuan. Other countries, especially ones hit by U.S. sanctions, are already trading in a currency other than the dollar. That is for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Mika Vitafi and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next program.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on the blessed month of Ramadan. During Ramadan, we should establish a spiritual relationship with ourselves and others. July 2nd, 2014. The environment of Ramadan is the environment of warmth, spirituality, honesty, and purity. We should try to make the most of this environment, both for the sake of our spiritual relationship with God. We should strengthen this spiritual and personal relationship with Allah, the Exalted, because the best and the greatest advantage for anyone is strengthening this relationship. And for the sake of our eternal life in the hereafter, because the real life exists in the hereafter, making the most of this environment is beneficial for both the hereafter and our life in this world. Besides, we should try to benefit from this spiritual and pure environment, which exists in the month of Ramadan on a public level, for establishing a proper and spiritual relationship between ourselves and other people, for making correct decisions and for adopting proper measures. In our relationships with other people, we should be optimistic, we should have trust in others, we should be kind and well-wishing.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Providing the people with simple iftar is a very appropriate act. August 9, 2013. It is good to pay attention to this issue, which is the act of providing the people with simple and unadorned iftar meals in our mosques and on the streets of many cities of the country, unlike the act of offering extravagant iftar meals, which we heard a number of people did. This is a very appropriate act. Under the pretext of offering iftar meals, these people engaged in extravagant acts instead of becoming an instrument for establishing a psychological relationship with the poor and the deprived in the month of Ramadan. They indulged themselves in carnal desires by doing this. We do not want to say that if somebody eats a delicious food during iftar, this is forbidden. No. According to Sharia, these things are not forbidden, but extravagance and overindulgence are forbidden. The extravagance which is sometimes witnessed in such occasions is forbidden. It is so much better for those who want to offer iftar meals to do this by cherishing the tradition which has become common.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Over a month ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The West, which had been warning Russia against such a move, resorted to providing aid to Kiev and decided not to join the war. It, however, used a different type of warfare, the economic one.
We're coming together to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian energy. Putin has issued Russia's energy resources to coerce and manipulate its neighbors. That's how he's used it. He's used the profits to drive his war machine. And that's why earlier this month I announced the United States would ban all imports of Russian energy.
The United States and its allies imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mainly targeting its energy and banking sectors. The decision is drawing criticism, including from among U.S. lawmakers. Thomas Massey, a Republican representative for Kentucky in the U.S. House, says no treaty can supersede the U.S. Congress in determining when America should go to war. He explains that the often cited Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which states that an attack on one member state will be met with a collective response, isn't binding. That's because Article 11 of the same treaty stipulates that the provisions of the pact must be carried out according to the constitutions of the respective member states.
The United States is putting its country and its citizens in a psychological and economic war against Russia. It's a war against Russia in every sense but a direct military conflict. And there's a very thin line, and we're very near crossing that line to direct military conflict. So what this guy is saying is a correct warning to the American people. We cannot let ourselves be pushed into war by default and by some kind of automatic mechanism that sidesteps what would be the constitutional and legal and political requirements that if we're going to go to war with a country, we have to have a congressional resolution for it.
Besides, as several officials and experts have been warning, cutting off a major country from the global supply chain will expose the whole world to risks that could snowball into a catastrophe of epic proportions. As the US takes aim at Russia, it leaves itself vulnerable to the possible ricochet. U.S. House Representative Thomas Massey agrees, saying the Western sanctions on Russia haven't been thought through. Massey says American farmers who are being cut off from Russia's fertilizers will be hit hard. But that's not all. Russia and Ukraine account for about a quarter of the world's wheat production combined. A prolonged conflict and sanctions on Russia will take a toll on the world's food supply, potentially exposing hundreds of millions to hunger around the world. The price of the sanctions is also being paid at the pumps, especially in the West, with fuel prices soaring to new highs, pushing up the inflation rate in countries like the UK to figures not seen in decades. Numerous academic studies have been conducted on the effectiveness of economic sanctions. They all indicate that the punitive measures do little other than hurt the ordinary citizens.
Sanctions are going to hurt Russia, and they're going to hurt everybody, you know. And Russia has learned to live with sanctions and got along okay, and maybe even better. They've learned to replace some of the things they depended upon. So whatever damage is going to be done to Russia, there is going to be equal or greater damage done to the other side of the sanctions.
Why insist on entering a game that won't have any real winners? Is inflicting pain on a rival worth taking equally, if not more painful, punches?
Afghanistan has suffered crisis after crisis over the past decades, but the situation has perhaps never been so grave. Afghan people now have to live with the terrible mess left after so many years of war. There is no doubt that most of the problems facing the South Asian nation have their roots in war. The United States and its Western allies have been widely criticized for their 20-year military campaign, which wreaked havoc in the country but failed to achieve its stated goals. Afghanistan is now at a critical point. It has turned into a historic test for the international community. This week, top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in China for their third conference on the situation. They seem to understand better than other countries what is at stake if Afghanistan fails completely. The foreign ministers of neighboring countries called on the Taliban to adopt further measures to improve living conditions and guarantee the basic rights of all Afghans, including women and ethnic minorities. The foreign ministers also renewed their call on the Taliban to form an inclusive government.
I think that there's potential significance in it if they can manage to produce the aid. And not only money aid, but if they can organize food shipments and fuel shipments and this sort of thing into Afghanistan and pressure for equitable distribution where it's necessary, then of course this conference could save Afghanistan.
Iran, which is hosting several million Afghan refugees, said during the conference that neighboring and friendly countries should strengthen cooperation in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and boost assistance to its people without political considerations. At the conference in China, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian proposed a security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by the neighbors. He also stressed that the root cause of problems in Afghanistan is the long-term occupation and misguided policies of the occupiers, mainly the United States. Afghanistan is grappling with an endless list of problems months after the chaotic withdrawal of the United States. The story of Afghanistan today is unending suffering for its people. Poverty and hunger have worsened nationwide. According to the World Food Program, 95% of Afghans do not have enough food to eat. Many millions of Afghan children face life-threatening levels of hunger. Meanwhile, outbreaks of deadly diseases among children are rife as the Afghan population cannot access adequate health care and routine vaccinations. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again raised the alarm about the situation.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Afghanistan has been reliant on foreign financial aid for a very long time, but the need for financial resources has never been so serious. Afghanistan's massive humanitarian crisis has its roots in foreign restrictions on its banking sector. U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have left international banks wary of allowing aid groups to transfer funds into the country. Meanwhile, the U.S. decision to keep billions of dollars in frozen Afghan funds held in the U.S. is being blamed for a large part of the crisis. Calls have been growing on the United States to immediately release the sum it seized from Afghanistan's central bank, causing a devastating hunger crisis. All eyes are on the U.S. now to see if it realizes the need to change course and move in line with those who are truly concerned about the situation in Afghanistan.
Thank you. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have concluded week-long tour of the Caribbean. The trip was to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year and saw William and Catherine also visit Jamaica and Bahamas. But the tour was marred by a series of gaffes and protests by local people over the visit. As the tour progressed, it became increasingly clear that a trip intended to show the royals as empathetic and in touch was sparking the totally opposite reaction.
The trip of the British royals to the Caribbean and Central America reflects the broader colonial relationship that the United Kingdom has had with the region. Countries like Jamaica, Trinidad, Belize, Barbados, so many others, Guyana in the region, that have been colonized and enslaved by British bankers, by a British royal family for centuries.
When William and Kate greeted cheering children by a football pitch who were standing behind a wire fence, the resulting imagery created a deeply uncomfortable look for the monarchy. And when they deliberately recreated the Queen and Prince Philip's journey on a Land Rover from decades ago, the wistful nod to a bygone era struck an odd tone in a country looking to move forward, not back. Earlier in the tour, William was forced to tackle Britain's historic role in the slave trade, expressing his sorrow that it ever happened. The move came following anti-colonial protests in Jamaica and Belize, but William fell short of a full apology. Jamaican President Andrew Holness said they will push for the island to be a republic with a referendum this year. Protesters outside the British High Commission in Jamaica handed over a letter signed by a group of 100 prominent individuals from Jamaica's Advocates Network calling for an apology and recognition of the need for atonement and reparations.
And so what the peoples of the Caribbean and also other places colonized by England are demanding is reparations. I think this is exactly what they mean by atonement, by paying for the sins of colonization and imperialism. We know that Barbados, Haiti, and so many other Caribbean countries, the sugar that was produced in those nations in the 1800s was worth millions today.
The United Kingdom has a dark colonial past in many different places of the world, including the Caribbean. The UK institutionalized a slave trade between the Caribbean, Africa, and London, stealing the wealth of its colonies to enrich itself. London, Bristol, and Liverpool, which were hubs of the slave trade, became wealthy and powerful. Britain formally abolished the slave trade in 1807, but only outlawed the slavery in 1834, after the Slavery Abolition Act was passed by the Parliament the year before.
And actually, millions of dollars of wealth from the Caribbean in sugar, in tobacco, in alcohol was extracted during the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, up until the 1900s, when many of these nations won independence from the crown.
The British government paid the slave traders £20 million in compensation, 40% of its budget. That is some £17 billion. The government took out a loan to pay it, which was only paid off by British taxpayer money in 2015. That means the British government, using public money, paid slave owners, but not those who were enslaved. Britain's colonial past and its treatment of former colonies and the residents have raised harsh criticism.
And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth, in order to maximize their profits. And what the Crown represents is exactly this.
The Commonwealth Nations, which was created after the first half of the 20th century, after decolonization of the British Empire, is a dark reminiscent of British past. And now calls are growing to abolish the institution. Indigenous groups from Canada are visiting the Vatican this week for meetings with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. They have held a meeting with the Pope discussing the Church's role in a system of boarding schools that abused Indigenous children for over 100 years as part of a government policy of forced assimilation. That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples, referred to as a process of healing and reconciliation. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves since last May at the schools attended by Indigenous children has opened old wounds. The residential schools were funded by the Canadian government and administered by churches. Canada's Indigenous people are now calling on the Pope to formally apologize as the head of the Catholic Church for its role in administering the facilities.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
The plea was made in a nearly one-hour meeting between the Pontiff and representatives of two of Canada's three largest Indigenous communities, the Métis and Inuit Nations. More than 30 delegates visiting the Vatican say an apology from Francis in Canada would be an important step in the healing process. Survivors of Canada's residential schools have also called on Pope Francis to provide them with unlimited access to church records on the institutions where thousands of Indigenous children were sexually abused and mistreated over the years.
In my opinion, the apology by the Pope would have a limited value. In that it would show that the church is recognizing its culpability and responsibility for the crimes that were committed against the First Nations. The real issue of reconciliation would be the release of documentation and papers concerning the residential schools, which to date the church has not done.
Over the years, the Pope has expressed his sorrow and sadness for the survivors of residential schools in Canada, but has stopped short of apologizing. Canada has been home to people for thousands of years and was first colonized by Europeans in the 16th century. Settlers took over and began to control Indigenous peoples. Colonizers imposed their own cultural values, religions, and laws, made policies that did not favor the Indigenous peoples. The nominal objective of residential schools was to educate Indigenous children, but the explicit objective was to create a system to isolate them from their own native culture and religion to assimilate them into the white Canadian settlers' culture. The Catholic Church operated nearly three-quarters of Canada's residential schools, seizing more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes between 1830s and mid-1990s, spending months or years isolated from their families, language, and culture. Many of the Indigenous children taken from their homes by the church school system were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died while attending the schools, and the search for more graves goes on. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded in 2015 the failed government policy amounted to cultural genocide.
It would bring, as I said, recognition that they have culpability, and that's been lacking thus far. The church has denied any responsibility for things that happened. They claimed that it was a good thing and that it would help, but what it did was it was a form of genocide. It was cultural genocide, and the church has to claim responsibility for that.
Pope Francis has heard firsthand the horrors of crimes committed at church-run residential schools in Canada from Indigenous survivors. That's a positive step in acknowledging the Church's role in this scandal. But will the Catholic Church and Pope Francis offer more than words?
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In actuality, it is the Palestinian existence that is in real jeopardy, says Ramzi Baru, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Gaza's forthcoming crisis might be worse than anything we have ever seen. Stay tuned for more. The water is back, one family member would announce in a mix of excitement and panic, often very late at night. The tactic of holding Palestinians hostage to the Zionist regime's water charity was so widespread during the first Palestinian Intifada, or uprising, to the extent that denying water supplies to targeted refugee camps, villages, towns, or whole regions was the first measure taken to subdue the rebellious population. This was often followed by military raids, mass arrests, and deadly violence, but it almost always began with cutting Palestinians off from their water supplies. The Zionist regime's water war on the Palestinians has changed since those early days, especially as the climate change crisis has accelerated the Zionist regime's need to prepare for grim future possibilities. Of course, this largely happens at the expense of the occupied Palestinians. In the West Bank, the Zionist regime continues to usurp Palestinian water resources from the region's main aquifers, the mountain aquifer and the coastal aquifer. Frustratingly, the Zionist regime's main water company, Mekorot, sells stolen Palestinian water to Palestinian villages and towns, especially in the northern West Bank region, at exorbitant prices. Aside from the ongoing profiteering from water theft, the Zionist regime continues to use water as a form of collective punishment in the West Bank, while quite often denying Palestinians, especially in Area C, the right to dig new wells to circumvent the Zionist regime water monopoly. According to Amnesty International, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank consume on average 73 liters of water a day per person. Compare this to an Israeli citizen who consumes approximately 240 liters of water a day, and even worse, to an illegal Israeli Jewish settler who consumes over 300 liters per day. The Palestinian share of water is not only far below the average consumed by Israelis, but is even below the recommended daily minimum of 100 liters per capita as designated by the World Health Organization. As difficult as the situation for West Bank Palestinians is, in Gaza, the humanitarian catastrophe is already in effect. On the occasion of World Water Day on March 22nd, Gaza's Water and Environmental Quality Authority warned of a massive crisis should Gaza's water supplies continue to deplete at the current dangerous rate. The authority's spokesman, Mazen Al-Banna, told reporters that 98% of Gaza's water supplies are not fit for human consumption. The consequences of this terrifying statistic are well known to Palestinians and, in effect, to international community as well. Last October, Mohammad Shahada of Euromed Monitor told the 48th UN Human Rights Council session that about one quarter of all diseases in Gaza are caused by water pollution, and that an estimated 12% of deaths among Gaza's children are linked to intestinal infections related to contaminated water. But how did Gaza get to this point? On May 25th, 4 days after the end of the latest Zionist regime war on Gaza, the charity Oxfam announced that 400,000 people in besieged Gaza have had no access to regular water supplies. The reason is that the Zionist regime military campaigns always begin with the targeting of Palestinian electric grids, water services, and other vital public facilities. According to Oxfam, 11 days of bombardment severely impacted the three main desalination plants in Gaza City. It is important to keep in mind that the water crisis in Gaza has been ongoing for years, and every aspect of this protracted crisis is linked to the Zionist regime. With damaged or ailing infrastructure, much of Gaza's water contains dangerously high salinity levels or is extremely polluted by sewage and other reasons. Even before the Zionist regime redeployed its forces out of Gaza in 2005 to impose a siege on the Strip's population from land, sea and air, Gaza had a water crisis. Gaza's coastal aquifer was entirely controlled by the Zionist regime military, which diverted quality water to the few thousand Jewish settlers, while occasionally allocating high saline water to the then 1.5 million Palestinian people, granted that Palestinians did not protest or resist the Zionist regime occupation in any way. Nearly 17 years later, Gaza's population has grown to 2.1 million, and Gaza's already struggling aquifer is in a far worse shape. The United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, reported that water from Gaza's aquifer is depleting due to over-extraction because people have no other choice. UNICEF added, worse pollution and an influx of seawater mean that only 4% of the aquifer water is fit to drink. The rest must be purified and desalinated to make it drinkable. In other words, Gaza's problem is not the lack of access to existing fresh water reserves, as the latter simply do not exist or are rapidly depleting, but the lack of technology and fuel that would give Palestinians in Gaza the ability to make their water nominally drinkable. Even that is not a long-term solution. The Zionist regime is doing its utmost to destroy any Palestinian chances at recovery from this ongoing crisis. More, it seems that Tel Aviv is only invested in making the situation worse to jeopardize Palestinian chances of survival. For example, last year, Palestinians accused the Zionist regime of deliberately flooding thousands of Palestinian dunams in Gaza when it vented its southern dams, which the Zionist regime uses to collect rainwater. The almost yearly ritual by the Zionist regime continues to devastate Gaza's ever-shrinking farming areas, the backbone of Palestinian survival under the Zionist regime's hermetic siege. The international community often pays attention to Gaza during times of the Zionist regime wars. And even then, the attention is mostly negative, where Palestinians are usually accused of provoking the Zionist regime's supposed wars. The truth is that, even when the Zionist regime's military campaigns end, Tel Aviv continues to wage war on the Gaza Strip's inhabitants. In actuality, it is the Palestinian existence that is in real jeopardy. When almost all of Gaza's water is not fit for human consumption because of a deliberate Zionist regime strategy, one can understand why Palestinians continue to fight back as if their lives are dependent on it, because they are.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month while people in Gaza struggle to observe it under inhuman conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped. And the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, this latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation of their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing two Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Bnei Brak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, which led to the killing of five Israelis and the perpetrator Dia Hamashi from Ya'bet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the two youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by three lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat in Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, But this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no confidence with a foreign conspiracy. Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled Prime Minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far. And